Okay, good morning, everybody. How are we? Good. Everybody comfortable? Yeah, make a living. All right, good. So we're at the final Parsha of Bereishis, Parsha Vayechi. And it is eventful in the sense that something very central happens, but again, like last week, there's not that many scenes in terms of activity. What's the central story of this parasha? What's the central event? The brachot, okay? I'd say that's part of the bigger event, which is Yaakov's death. This is essentially the passing of Yaakov, with the title of the parasha sounding almost ironic, which means Vayechi, and he lived. Which, of course, no spoilers, he didn't. Although, having said that, we'll get to a position where there's a debate among the rabbinic sages about whether Yaakov actually died. The way his death is described is different to the other two forefathers, where there are three verbs that describe their passing, including the word vayamot. The word vayamot does not appear with Yaakov. It says v'yasef, he was gathered in and he expired, but it doesn't say and he died. And there are suspicions among the sages that maybe his death wasn't entirely the way it seems, and somehow he escaped our mortal fate, and somehow was whisked away like Eliyahu or something else, or somehow there's a discussion in the Gemara about it, at which point a sage jumps in and says, they mummified him. What do you mean he didn't die? It says, that you're right, it doesn't say the Yamot, but it says they mummified him. I hope he died, otherwise that's uncomfortable. He said, look, we're doing homiletics here, is what the sages suggested, and actually there's something about life and immortality that goes beyond the human coil. For the Harry Potter fans, there are things worse than death. That's what Dumbledore tells Voldemort. Doesn't seem to understand that, but what can you do? Either way, so let's run through the parsha. There's a central pasuk I do want to turn our attention to. There's a nice image there that's not that tied to the pasuk, but relates to one of the opening scenes, one of the most iconic in this week's parsha. So let's run through stage by stage. First thing to point out, because it's the first thing that Rashi says, so I feel obligated to note it, is that something we may not notice when we open our Chumash, something structurally about the text as it appears in the Torah scroll. There is no gap between last week's parsha and this week's parsha, which is unusual. It is what's called satum. It's closed, like the sentence just runs on. So for those who are Balei Korah, those people who read from the Torah, it's sometimes quite hard to find the beginning of the parasha when you're trying to find the place. And Rashi suggests that there is a reason. This is not without cause that it is closed. Why might you think that this would be closed, a smooth run-on from last week into this week? What are your suggestions? Okay, maybe there isn't a large gap between last week and this week. There is a direct link between last week and this week, which was Yaakov coming down and passing away is part of the whole story. Any other suggestions? Excellent. Rashi has two. One of which he says is, both of which are linked to what happens in this week's parasha. One is that with the passing of Yaakov, there was a blindness to the Jewish people. Satum is equated to the clothing of the eyes, the clothing of the heart. There was a pain and a blindness in Yaakov's passing that basically leads in not from last week, but connects us to next week, which is the beginning of slavery and the incapacity to see our future, which links to the second reading, which is in the middle of this. Yaakov gathers his sons and says, let me tell you about the end days, and then doesn't. So there is, at the core of this parsha, something mysterious, obscure, unpredictable, unseen, something closed from us. That's the way that Rashi opens his commentary on the parsha. But the first scene is, we're told that Yaakov lived there for 17 years. Vayechi, by the way, I'm not really a numerical guy. I think I mentioned this in our first year when we came to Noach about numerology. But Vayechi has the numerical equivalent of, quickly, 34, excellent. Yes, I'm glad I was right on that one, 34. And he lived, being 34. The association is made that 34 of Yaakov's years were the years where he really lived, where he really felt like he had a life. And what were those 34 years? The 17 years before Yosef was sold and the 17 after he discovered he was still alive, and those were the years of his life, which is, I guess, a sad remark for the rest of his brothers, but a signal that on some level, having a whole family without a gaping hole was something that gave him his life. He then brings Yosef, so we're told he lived in Egypt for 17 years. He brought Yosef in and he made him take an oath. He said, do for me chesed ve'emet, do for me kindness and truth. And what did he want? Not to be buried in Egypt, or more to the point, to be buried in Israel. In fact, those two things, for some of the commentaries, is why he says, do me a chesed and an emet. It's not just hyperbolic, it's just not rhetorical, but I want you to do two things for me, one of which is a kindness and one of which is a truth. And the kindness is, please don't bury me in Egypt because of the idolatrous connections. What else was he worried about being buried in Egypt? He was worried that he might become a totem, like a worshipped site. Anyone know another Midrashic comment on why he didn't want to be buried in Egypt? What was in Egypt's future? Kenim. He didn't want the lice in the ground. He didn't want to be itchy in the afterlife. So he said, please don't bury me here. This is not going to be a good place. And Kenim itself, when we come to those parasha, will be interesting. Presumably Yaakov would have been buried in Goshen. Why would there have been any of the plagues in the Jewish area? So we'll come to that where in a couple of weeks' time, where there's a possibility that some of the plagues, in fact, did infect the Jewish towns. And comments on that we'll come to at the time. He requests his chesed ve'emet, which Rashi says it's really not two things, but one, chesed shel emet, which is dealing with the affairs of those who have passed. And why is that the truest kindness to deal with the dead? Traditionally, because they can't, this is not a mutual deal where I do something for you. This is not what we're all now accustomed to being told as a quid pro quo. There is no quid, there is no quo. Whichever one is missing, there is none of that. You're just doing something unilaterally for somebody in good faith. At that point, yes. Yeah, so Rashi has to contend with that. And Vav, the truth is, an interesting letter. Sometimes it can mean and, sometimes it can mean but, sometimes it can mean though. And I guess he's saying that it's somewhat possessive here. But it is a stretch. And the other readings are that there are two things he's asking, one of which is not to be in Mitzrayim, one of which is to be in Israel. Some people say it means I want to be in Israel, which is the Emet, but the Chesed is please bury me in the Ma'arat Machpelah. There are two distinct requests here being asked. And he makes Joseph swear. There is, again, a reluctance to trust people. In Yaakov's world, mentally, he is so used to upheaval and betrayal and unpredictability. He says, I need you to take an oath to commit to this. At that point, Yosef brings in his two children, Ephraim and Menashe. We have the famous blessing of Ephraim and Menashe, where the hands are switched. We have the authentic image here on the page with the hand switched. Rembrandt has the hand switched. Everybody has the hand switched. It's a remarkable moment. And Yaakov is, sight has faded. We're told that he couldn't see very well. He had to ask Yosef who they were and where to put his hands. And he seems to be bumbling and confused. And Yosef says, your hands are in the wrong place. He says, trust me, I know what I'm doing. And I'll talk a little bit more about that scene on Friday night. But it is worth asking a couple questions about this moment. Two things. Number one, what was the bracha that he gave? It's been turned into a very popular song. Hamalach ha-goel oti. Right, we sing that with the Kol in the Arim on Simchas Torah. And actually, the first year my daughter was with me, my eldest daughter, three now, in Chicago, we were standing there under the talus, and everyone's like so excited, and it's so beautiful, you've got tons of kids, and you're singing, and half the children burst out crying. Anyone know why the kids are crying? They think it's bedtime. Right, she was like, I'm not sleeping now, what are you talking about? And so by the second year, I said, Ariella, we're not going to sleep now. We're just going to sing. It's not bedtime. It is not bedtime. We're just going to sing. And you can see a little panic even. So, but we got over that now. But now I know how to make her stop anything suddenly. You just start singing Hamalcha Go All the Tees. You think it's bedtime, we're done. That doesn't work so much anymore, even at bedtime. Either way, so that is the blessing. Hamalach Gagol Latim Kol Ra, and the essential end of the blessing is V'yidgu Larov Bekerov Ha'aretz. Okay, we'll warm it up. V'yidgu Larov Bekerov Ha'aretz, which means what? V'yidgu? You should multiply like fish in the midst of the land. Now, I don't know how many of you are marine biologists, but fish in the middle of the land don't do very well. They usually require water. And so it's an odd expression. What is being intended here? You should multiply like fish in the midst of, obviously, not that you should be like fish, right? It didn't want you to go swimming. It wants to be in the midst of the land. But what is the connection? What is the metaphor? What is the blessing that you should be like fish? And I'm opening here to any associations you have or suggestions you have. What is so key about multiplying like fish? Why is that a... If I were to bless my children, it would probably be the last thing that intuitively I would come up with. You should be like fish. You know, when people choose what they have for dinner, chicken or fish, people usually go for chicken. Fish is seen as like... Yeah. So why are we blessing people like fish?
Have large numbers.
Yeah, anyone seen Finding Nemo? Right? For those of you who haven't, it's not necessary for you to have seen it to get this point, is that when fish propagate, they have thousands of eggs, right? So it's really just the most multiplous progenitor that there is in nature. I think that's true. Maybe insects. I don't know. That's revolting to even think about. But fish have thousands of eggs. So it's really just a blessing. You should have lots and lots and lots and lots of children. That is the most, I guess, intuitive reading of this. But there are so many reasons. Firstly, Bekerov Ha'aretz, in the midst of the land. We usually take that. Why Bekerov Ha'aretz? V'yidgularov Ba'aretz. What does Bekerov Ha'aretz mean? In the midst of the land. Why is that important? What does he mean? I'm not going anywhere. Say again. Very interesting. So maybe there is hanging in this bracha the latent understanding that there will be difficult moments. Bekerov Ha'aretz, this really should be read, you should multiply like fish, even. Bekerov Ha'aretz, even in the midst of the land, even when you're cast out in the diaspora, you should understand that there will be blessing. And in fact, Diane mentioned to me from some podcast today, she heard about Ephraim and Menashe later in Jewish history attacking each other. Anyone familiar with the scene later in history in the book of Shoftim when Ephraim and Menashe go to civil war? Right. Anyone heard Shibboleth? Anyone seen The West Wing? There's an episode called Shibboleth. Anyone ever heard the term or phrase Shibboleth? It means a code, right? A Shibboleth means a password or a code. This originates with the biblical story, which in fact in The West Wing, President Bartlet sits back and tells his staff where it originates in the book of Judges, where Ephraim and Menashe had different dialects. One would say Shibboleth and the other would say Sibboleth. In the same way I mentioned that we say shalom, and other Semitic customs say salam, that shin and the sin interchange in different regions, and Ephraim and Menashe had the difference. Litvak, Hasidish, right, with the oohs and the ees, absolutely. And the understanding was that there would be troops on guard to suspect Ephraimites, and if they said, say Shibboleth, and if they said Shibboleth, they'd kill them. And there is a reading, V'yidgu larov, you should multiply like fish. How do fish usually die at human hands? Caught by the throat. And so there is a reading that suggests that, again, latent in this bracha is the idea that Ephraim and Menashe are actually going to assault each other because of the throat, leading to all sorts of death later in history. It's a bit of a downer at this moment when you're blessing them, but I think there is a notion that even in the depths of despair, there is a bracha, there is a blessing, even Bekerov Ha'aretz, absolutely. There's an interesting meaning of Bekerov Ha'aretz, that the Baal HaTurim says Bekerov in the midst of the land is actually not a horizontal point, but a vertical one. In the midst of the land, meaning your children should multiply even in the middle of the earth. Is that ringing any bells for anybody? Does that sound ludicrous? It could be both. Could be both. There is, talking about Parashat Shmot, V'yirbu atzmu ma'od ma'od b'kerev ha'aretz. So they started multiplying in the midst of the land. The Gemara there, actually, in Sota says, what happened to the Jews? The Egyptians tried to assault the Jewish people. They wanted to slaughter all the children. So in an act of despair, what did the mothers do? They hid their children in the ground. And it's a horrific scene. In the abstractions of Pilpul and Midrash, where you can entertain comic ideas, but you try to imagine the scene where mothers are burying their children because they think at least this fate is in my hands, and they won't suffer as much as they will at the hands of these axes. And they bury them in the ground, and the Gemara describes the mothers burying them, and then the Egyptians, suspecting the Jewish mothers having done that, taking plows and going up and down the field and saying, okay, we've tilled this, they're done. And then in 9 months' time, the babies all sprouted out the ground and grew out of the ground. That's Bekerev Haaretz, that they grew literally Bekerev in the midst of the land. And this is the blessing that Yaakov's giving, that there should be some sort of metaphysical, miraculous capacity for these children to survive the horrific attacks, be insulated from that sort of assault. Again, whether you read this literally or whether you take this as a bracha in metaphoric sense, the capacity that even Bekerev Haaretz, in the midst of diaspora or in the depths of the soil, you should have the capacity to grow and propagate and prosper. That seems to be the way Bekerev Haaretz is being read. So the fish, why fish? Rabbi Ephraim Mervitz, anyone familiar with the name? I missed out a word in his title, actually. Chief. Yeah, the chief. All hail to the chief. Rabbi Mervitz gave a shiur in his inaugural year, and he gave five different readings of why being compared to fish is so important. And he actually based a number of them on Midrash. One of them is, when you have an animal that's kosher, is the entirety of the animal kosher? Not always. You'll get hanasher, there is chelev, in some animals, there are different parts of different animals, even after shechita, that isn't kosher. But a fish, if it's a kosher fish, it's a kosher fish. There are parts of it you may not want to eat. In fact, you may not want to eat any of it, but it's all kosher. So this is a bracha, v'yidgu larov, that you should have some sort of comprehensive integrity. This is a bracha that you should be like fish. You shouldn't have parts of you that are improper or intolerable or excluded, but this is an inclusive message of integrity to the Jewish people and his children. In addition to the kashrut, in terms of its entirety, say again?
It's parv.
It's parv, okay, that's all. We're not going to get into chicken, but yes, that's... Well, it depends what came first, the... Yeah, there you go. All right, that moved us on pretty quick. So, talking about kashrut as well, what are the signals of kashrut for animals? One is external and one is internal. What are the signals of kashrut for a fish? Fins and scales, both on the outside. And Rabbi Mervitz again suggested that actually the bracha is that you should have children who are proud, who wear their identity, in his words, on their sleeve. People who are not like half and half reluctant. You should be like fish in the midst of the land, meaning even among peoples, you should have pride. You should stand up. You should feel confident and have conviction in your Jewish identity. He also said there's only one way to tell in nature if a fish is alive, because when you're in water, water is usually in motion. And if you're just running with the water, there's no way to tell. The only way to tell if a fish is really alive is if it's swimming against the stream. And the bracha here was that they should have the confidence to stand up and do what's right, even if it's against the stream, against the current. That was a suggestion he gave. And then the Midrash says that actually there's something very odd about fish. Again, I'm not a marine biologist. I assume the word is not fishologist, but I'm not that either. But the Midrash describes in nature when it begins to rain, fish often come to the top and start jumping up. Anyone ever seen that? Good. Okay, that happens. There you go. And the Midrash says, it's so strange. Why are they jumping up at water? They physically live in water. What are they getting so excited about? And the Midrash says, just as fish who live in water get excited by little bits of extra water, Jews who surround themselves in Torah get excited by chiddush, by novelty, by innovation, by creativity. And the bracha is that we should be like fish, that despite the fact that we are suffused, our lives are surrounded by virtue and tradition, we should be open and excited by creativity, by novelty, by newness, even if it's all the same. That's so there's a lot in terms of V'yid Gula Rov. Next time you're singing that and the kids are crying because they think you're putting them in bed, there's something to think about to distract you from the tears. Now, Yismech Elokim Kefraim. No, I got that wrong because I'm not used to saying that one. Thank you. Yisimcha Elokim Kefraim Chemenasha. You should... That's not as bad as my father, because when you've got boys and girls, you give the wrong one to the wrong one. I'm just not used to either. I've got two girls. So that's the formula for the bracha to give to kids often on Friday night. The one we give to young ladies, the one that I give, Yismech Elokim Kesara Rivka Racha Valeah, where does that come from? Yeah, correct. Nobody knows. It's relatively recent, and in fact, this is what I do, but there are suggestions, people have suggested that actually it's much better to use a biblical verse, a pasuk, and there are lots of psukim that relate to praising women in the footsteps of the matriarchs and their ancestors, and there have been tshuvot written that maybe use a pasuk instead of just kind of a riff on the boys' one. A rabbi of mine in England actually just blesses his daughters, what is it? Yisimcha Elokim Chefraim Chemenasha. You know, he's not saying I want you to have beards, I want you to be men, but you should be... Meaning, whatever the virtues that we are taking from Ephraim and Menashe, we want you to have that too. And this is kind of a non-gendered, although it is innately gendered in some sense, but it's a non-gendered bracha that should be given across the board. That was his suggestion. Again, tradition's tradition, and we do what we do, and we're all fiddlers on the roof in some sense. But what is it about Ephraim and Menashe? Why is their bracha the one we bless our children with, as opposed to any other of the brachot? This seder, as someone pointed out, is... suffused with bracha. We have all the kids. Maybe we wouldn't want to give Shimon and Levi's bracha to our kids, which is, you did horrific things, you ruined stuff, I don't want any part of you. Farewell. Maybe that would be a down on a Friday night. But what about the other kids? Why Ephraim and Menashe? Anyone ever heard reasons? Yeah.
Of all the brothers of the tribes, they were the only ones who lived in a sense away from the tradition of Yaakov. And that despite the fact that they were living in the Egyptian culture, they retained who they were. And so it's a lesson to future generations that even if you're not within a ghettoized community, in a sense, retain who you are and your heritage and your language, just as the tribe subsequently did.
Great. That's what you're going to say. So that, I think, is the view that many people teach and learn, that they were the first generation raised outside Israel. They were the first generation raised in a foreign culture entirely. They spent their life... by the way, how old were Ephraim and Menashe during the blessing? If we think about all the images and the pictures, how old would you guess they are? Say again? Roughly.
Under bar mitzvah.
Kids, little kids, right? Is that the case? How do we know that's definitely not the case?
They were born before Yaakov
came down, and how long has he been there now?
17 years.
So, 20s they're in? So again, the image of kind of little kids, they're like, and I don't have any 20-year-old children, but I'm told sometimes they're hard to kind of corral into what you want. But you imagine these 20-year-olds aren't, yes, go on, you know. But that's, so it's a very different painting. But they're older already. Now, what is it about them? The traditional view is that they were the first generation reared in a foreign culture, and they still held on to their identity. V'yid Gula Rov is very fitting in that sense, that they were still proud Jews. And that's definitely the most popular reading of why they are the paradigms of the bracha that we give. There are other readings, too. There are suggestions that they had very different roles in the way that they lived their lives. Anyone know what functions they both held? Traditionally, again, we're not told this per se in the text, but traditionally, Ephraim was the scholar who spent his time in studies, and Menashe was the administrator who spent his time aiding his father in running the country. And actually, the bracha is to try to unify these two patterns. You should be like Ephraim and Menashe. You shouldn't have to segregate these roles out, but you should be able to... And this is sponsored by Yeshiva University motto, Torah Umada, that we should try our best within ourselves to, another word they like, synthesize Torah Umada. You could go to Landers as well and do Torah Parnasa. Say again. You could do B'nai Kiva, Torah Vavoda. Yeah, we're big fans. Torah Derech Eretz. We could do all of those. But there is a theme that we want to synthesize within a single individual, what Ephraim and Menashe symbolized individually. It's also worth pointing out there is something. These are not just the first generation of children since Avram to be raised other than Avram, outside of Israel in a foreign culture. There's something else unique about Ephraim and Menashe as siblings, something that we have not seen for the entire book of Bereishis among siblings. That was a clue. They haven't tried to kill each other, right? For a start. Yes, you're friends, but I guess that was an understatement, is that this is the first generation that haven't been at each other's throat, right? With Avram's kids, there were reports of Yishmael torturing, tormenting, trying to kill his brother. This one's evicted from the house. The next generation, you literally have calls for murder. One chases the other down. The next generation, they literally sell him. They discuss killing him as an option. And now you've got two brothers, and guess what they're doing? They're just being brothers, right? They're not doing anything. He says, you should be like Ephraim and Menashe. And this isn't to disparage the history of the other brothers. They all had their own circumstances and context. But the blessing is, you should have, may everybody just get along. Let's not try to kill or harm each other. Let's not judge or suspect each other. So that's why they see seen as paradigms. And these are all little pieces along the way. Then after that bracha, we have the main bracha scene where Yaakov gathers his sons, he brings them in, he says, let me tell you about Acharit HaYamim. Let me tell you about the end of days. And you imagine they're sitting there going, oh great, when's Mashiach coming? We're very excited. Oh, this is helpful. And what happens? He doesn't tell them what happens. He just gives them brachot. And there is a question about why that shift happens. And the Rashbam and other literalists say, calm down. And he says, Acharit HaYamim. He doesn't mean I'm going to tell you the end of days. You know, we're putting that. He just means, let me tell you about the end of my life. Let me tell you about priorities. Let me give you brachot. And he follows through exactly on that. Although there are traditions that he was going to reveal the end of days, but it was suddenly, the inspiration was taken away. And the Gemara says, once that inspiration was removed, suddenly Yaakov had suspicions. What was his suspicion? That maybe one of these kids isn't worthy. If the inspiration has been taken from me, there's got to be something in the room that's infecting my prophetic receptivity. There's something that's putting me off. So he says, are you guys with me? Are we on the same page? Are you part of the program here? At which point, what do the sons all say in unison? Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, according to tradition. It's not in the Pesukim. According to tradition, they say, listen, O Israel. And who's Israel? Yaakov, not talking to the nation as Moses. And this has been used homiletically through the ages, that when we say Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, it's multidirectional. We're speaking to the future, the nation, and we're speaking to the past, the fathers of the nation. Shema Yisrael, hear our father, Israel. The Lord of God, the Lord is one. At which point Jacob responds, Baruch Shem Kavod, and that's where the origin of that phrase comes from, according to that tradition. Because nobody knows where that phrase begins. Why do we say Baruch Shem Kavod after we say Shema? Where does that come from? Who has that? Who does that phrase belong to, traditionally? Right, we say it out loud only once a year, Yom Kippur. Why do we say it out loud on Yom Kippur? Because we're like angels, so let's track back. It belongs to the angels. We've got kind of this spread traditions about where this comes from. So why does Yaakov get to say it out loud? Why does Moshe not get to say it? There's all sorts of background history on the potency of that phrase. But that's traditionally a scene read into this moment when Yaakov starts to suspect his children. And again, this is all lore, L-O-R-E. But at the core of this lore, there is a hint about the psyches of these figures, that at the moment when he's about to bless them, what do the sages see in Yaakov? Suspicion. You see, Yaakov sitting there thinking, are you guys all okay? There is a suspicion that never dies. And what we'll see, the brothers have that same suspicion of whom? Yosef, that he never really forgave them. There is too much assumption of virtue here for these characters to cope with. It can't be that Yosef is that good. It can't be that the brothers have really healed themselves. Again, we don't have any direct discussion with Yaakov and his sons about what they did, even though it's evident that he must know something went up. We said last week that he was brought a coat covered in blood with a story about a death That didn't happen, obviously, and they don't seem to talk it out. But there's this latent suspicion constantly among these figures. Either way, Yaakov then gives the brachot to the various children. Yehuda gets the largest kind of letter count in terms of bracha. Some of them get a sentence, some of them get more. Reuven gets an interesting one about being like unsteady like water. Shimon and Levi are again accused of being vicious and violent, and the other brachot get different brachot compared to different animals. We've got wolves and hinds, and fascinating associations. And anyone seen the Midrash says that the volumes, five of them, the Midrash says it goes wild on this. It's got pages and pages and pages of what all the brachot mean and stand for as they've been. Because again, when you've got images, you've got a lot of freedom to interpret in the same way as Yaakov's ladder and all these kind of imagistic visions give rise to all sorts of interpretations, but we won't dive into all of that. So he gives the brachot, and then we have the death scene. Yaakov lifts his feet up onto the bed, and he expires. Lahavdil, like Yoda, he disappears into the night, his robes disappear, and he's gone, and he has won, not with the force, but with the faith. He's gone. Yosef falls on his father and cries, at which point the brothers think, ooh. Well, let's turn the page. See what the brothers think. I say turn the page. I was on the back of mine. Keep the front of your page. Sorry. You can look at the back page. There's always something inspiring about a blank sheet of paper. But we'll look on page one. V'yiru achei Yosef, and the brothers of Joseph saw ki meit avihem, that their fathers have died. Anything strange about the pasuk so far? Again, we haven't had too much of a chance. We've got a little bit of time now to actually put pressure on this pasuk. As we're reading, what strikes you as unusual? Could be different. Making a statement. Ambiguous. Extra. Missing. V'yiru achei Yosef ki meit avihem, and the brothers of Joseph saw that their father had died. What catches your attention? Anything?
Why Yosef? The brothers of Yosef, they all saw it. And the children saw it. Their father died.
Interesting. So at this stage, why are they being singled out? Okay, excellent. Anything else? Ki meit avihem. And the brothers saw ki meit avihem. How would you, what would be the most intuitive translation? That. What else can ki mean?
Because
their father died. So maybe that they're seeing not just, this isn't just an observation, but there is a causation here. Anyone ever heard that famous turn of phrase between what a chronicle is and what narrative is? The king died and the queen died. That's a chronicle. The king died and the queen died of grief. That's a story. So maybe the key here is shifting this from a chronicle. They saw that he died, but they saw that because he died, this is an insinuation of something is going to happen, which is what the rest of the pasuk will fulfill. Yeah.
Could also be
they were framed. The yiru, right. So it's a what does it mean on the face? What had we read it as? And they saw that he died. It's like, well, interesting. The yiru achei Yosef, and they were afraid. So it's interesting. The root, Yareh and Ra'ah, do operate differently, but there's a lot of ambiguity about how that plays out, and it could in some ways be seen both ways. The same comes up when Aaron passes away. Aaron, much later on, when Aaron passes away, V'yiru ha'am ki meit Aaron, that the people saw that Aaron died, and there's a question, how did they see it? It took place somewhere else, and the Midrash essentially suggests that there was some sort of apparition that the entire people saw of his coffin floating in the air. But it's also possible to read, and the Gemara says that they were afraid that he died, so it's possible, yeah, they were scared. But why would you push in that direction? Saying that they saw that he died seems a little redundant, right? What do you mean they saw that he died? Yes, they were there, he died, we know, they saw, it's a strange thing to say. So what might V'yiru mean? Not just that they saw, or that they were afraid, but if you're taking it as as Ra'ah, they saw, what does it mean to see?
They understood.
Right, there is a suggestion that perception is more than just visual. It is also an understanding. They understood that because he died, something was coming.
I think it also could have said by Yeru B'nei Yaakov, and instead it says Achei Yosef.
So excellent.
Clearly the shift now is that they're no longer B'nei Yaakov. There's something going to happen here that is definitely distinctly related to Yosef.
Excellent. The way that they're characterized is worth noting. It says, Ache Yosef, the brothers of Joseph. They could also be described as the children of Jacob, the grandchildren of Yitzchak, the great-grandchildren of Avram. They could be given their own names. They could be called Ha'ivrim. Why are they being called Ache Yosef is key. One could be narrative ploy. This is suggesting that the drama is shifting towards their relationship with Yosef. What else could this be telling us? That they live in a world where Yosef is the powerhouse, right? Their relationship with their father publicly is insignificant. They're all known as the brothers of Joseph. This is true in the contemporary world as well. When someone gains power in a family, everyone's known as their sibling, their brother, their father, whatever the case is.
It also excludes Yosef. Like, the brothers of Yosef's father sounds like Yosef didn't.
Interesting, right. If it would have said V'yiru b'nei Yaakov, he would have been part of that. So V'yiru Ache Yosef, in some ways, though it attends to the fact that he's the center of attention, it also puts him at a distance. Interesting.
Well, just to put it in context, I mean, Yaakov died 15 psukim earlier.
How many?
14 psukim earlier. He's buried by the time this is said.
Uh-huh.
So this is after he dies. And then he's buried, the negotiation with Paro. And then the brothers and Yosef come back from burying Yaakov and very strong. Now they're back in Egypt.
Right, so excellent, thank you. So when we do kind of the bird's eye view summary, sometimes the context falls away, which is, this isn't at the foot of the bed when Yaakov passes away, V'yiru, and then they saw, but this is after they've taken him up on a huge procession up to the land of Israel. He's eulogized, he's buried, they come back, and then they say V'yiru, and they saw that he died. They'd have to be pretty delayed to figure out that where's Yaakov gone? He's gone. So there's clearly connotations that they understood something. This wasn't just a visual issue that, oh my gosh, we're just facing this reality, but they understood that something had changed. And what that was, interestingly enough, if you look in this third box, Rav Hirsch says, Kol od meruchzim habanim saviv avo em, as long as children are centered around a mother or a father, Harehem motzi'im b'horim, they find in their parents et mishan dabar ka'achdut, a crutch which brings people together. Chiluke de'ot ze'irim motzi'im gam ben banim hagunim, and even small differences do arise among even good siblings. Even happy siblings have disagreements about things. Ach kol od chayim ha'horim, but as long as their parents are alive, yitrachaku avanim ha'machloket l'manorim, they tend not to fight too much. Again, I don't know if everyone has different experience, but on the whole, he's suggesting that as long as a core glue of the family is around, there is a center point, an axis on which all the children turn, even good siblings who have small disagreements will suppress them to maintain that central focus in their life. But once parents pass away, that connection, that link, that bridge weakens. Einhem marbim odli fagesh, they tend not to get together so much anymore. Harehem naasim zarim zeleze, they become estranged from one another. Mishasha aveim chaldula amud barakaz, once the parent no longer sits in the center. So kal v'chomer shekan lo haya ze eletivi, so all the more so, this wasn't a group of kids who'd spend their life together vacationing in the summers. These were a group of kids who tried to sell each other, tried to kill each other, fighting and arguing. So it's obviously natural that they would think, now that our father's gone, all right, so we'll do Thanksgiving on our own. Thank you, we'll be okay. And here, the suggestion is Ha'achim Ra'u. This is what the brothers saw. Hirgishu Sha'avimeinu. They felt that their father's presence was no longer there. And perhaps that's what made them suspect that Yosef was angry. They didn't get to see each other very much anymore. And they're starting to think, well, Yosef doesn't come out. And what he's suggesting is, he's not putting a judgment on this at the moment. The fact that siblings, once parents pass away, tend to drift apart might be sad. It might be tragic, but he's not saying it's bad, it's wrong. He's just saying it's a fact of life that tends to happen. And it's natural that in the case of Yosef, it would happen even more, because they did have differences, major differences, historically. But it is that drifting apart that the brothers may have read as, oh, Yosef hates us. And maybe it was just they were drifting apart, but they read that as Yosef is planning, he's plotting, he never truly forgave us, we're all going to die, right? So they were misreading this drifting apart as some sort of hostility. That's the way Rav Hirsch and others read this scene. It just reminded me, when my grandfather passed away, I'm trying to remember when it was about 8 years ago, he knew he was in his final days of decline. He was totally mentally present, but he knew he was in his last days. And my uncle from Israel, my uncle and aunt were sitting with him, and they remember being quite, and I don't mean to be comic about it, they remember being quite taken aback. At one point, he looked at them and he said, "Don't drift apart. Try to keep together." And they kept thinking, is he picking up on something in our marriage, or is he talking about the siblings? Because he said, "Don't drift apart." He said, "We're okay." That's not. And the presumption that everybody reached was he was talking about the kids. And he thought that was very important that we try to maintain a connection, which we do try to do. But this is a concern that Rav Hirsch says the brothers were seeing as a signal of hostility. The Chizkuni actually suggests that that drifting apart the brothers understood was a natural fact of life as you grow up. And we see this in families too. In my wife's family, her father's one of nine, and they have tons of siblings, they all have kids. And when my wife was little, they used to spend Chagim together all the time. So her first cousins were just extended siblings. But as you grow up, and there are like 400 of you, you tend not to see each other very much anymore. And it is sad as you grow up, you lose connection. You're not at everybody's simchas as much. And it does become a difficulty, but it's also natural that would happen. But the brothers misread that. The Chizkuni suggests, Kishishev Mikforet Aviv, actually, when they were returning from burying their father, they came back on an interesting route, a difficult route. On the way back, they passed a nice little pit. I was trying to think, I was going to say canyon or something. They came by a little hole in the ground, and they saw Yosef standing at the side of the hole, saying a bracha. And the bracha he said was, that God did a miracle for me in this place and I survived. And the brothers are thinking, oh, I guess he didn't forget. I guess he still feels the raw power of the miracle that saved him from that horrific circumstance. Maybe something's up here. And it wasn't just his drifting apart, but they saw in Yosef this attention to pass that he hasn't gotten over this. He's still thinking about this. The misreading on their part is they think that if you're still thinking about the past, you're still imprisoned by it. And actually, Yosef was capable of knowing about the past and transforming that experience into something redemptive that they couldn't cope with. And that's what he says to them. And he says, no. After they say, by the way, what do the brothers say to him? After they see that Yosef, they suspect him, and they say to him, by the way, Dad asked us. He gave us in his final moments when you were dealing with the procession and figuring everything out. He said, oh, by the way, make sure that Yosef forgives you. So we have to tell you. We wouldn't say it otherwise, but Dad said that we should tell you that you should forgive us. Did he say that to them? We don't know, but the text doesn't seem to tell us. So at least the text is trying to give the impression that they're inventing this, which is justified by the commentators as they were kind of white lies for the sake of peace. They're trying to draw people together so that you can be a little inventive. There was Kant. Anyone know Kant, Immanuel Kant? He felt that something called the categorical imperative means that if something is morally improper, it is universally improper. And the famous rebuke of Kant by a number of philosophers was, so you're telling me, this was obviously later in history than when Kant lived, they said, so you're telling me some nice Polish person is hiding Jews in the basement and a Nazi comes, are you hiding any Jews in the house? Kant says you have to say yes in the basement, or can you say no and lie? And that was the rebuke of Kant, who said if something is categorically immoral, it should never be done. You can never lie, and it's actually much better that you tell the truth and then you try to figure a way out, but that you can't break moral law. And Jewish law does not look on most things in that light. Most things give way in one circumstance or another. There are some categorical imperatives in Jewish life that never give way. murder among them, other things that we are never allowed to do, in irrelevant of the circumstance. But lying is not one of them. In fact, not only do the brothers get justified for lying here, do other people lie? Who else lies in the biblical text?
Everybody.
And not just... Okay, so let's look higher up the chain. Who else lies? Higher up the chain? Cain and Hevel. Further up? Let's go even higher. Okay, let's go before the snake. And we're not going to use the snake as a model, but God, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, appears to lie. And I'm not saying this because I don't want to get fired, so I'm not saying this on my own. Chazal point this out. The biblical text says this. What happens? Sarah hears that she's going to give birth, and she says, I'm going to have birth? What are you talking about? Avram's old. We're not going to have kids. And then HaKadosh Baruch Hu goes to Avram and says, your wife said that you're never going to have kids because she's old. She didn't say that. She said, because he's old. God didn't hear properly. He wasn't paying attention. So the assumption is that I'm going to stir up fights in a marriage. Meaning my point here is not to make them angry with each other. My point here is to talk about Sarah. That's actually an interesting discussion about why Sarah was being told off for laughing. Who else laughed at the news that they were going to have a son? Avram. Does he use the same word? Exact same word. Sachat. They both laughed on hearing they were going to have kids, and Sarah's told off. So one way to read that is, women always get blamed for everything. Right? Meaning men can laugh, men can get away with stuff, but if we do that, we're called shrill. If we do this, we're called that. And I'm sure at some level there's truth to that. But this has been read, interestingly, and this is not by a traditional commentator. This was a peer of mine who I can't remember if they saw it somewhere or not. But actually, who's being told off in this scene? When Avram is accosted by God, because God doesn't tell Sarah off, right? He doesn't say, Sarah, why are you laughing? He goes to Avram and says, Sarah laughed. Sarah says, no, I didn't. He says, yes, you did, you laughed. Why is he going to Avram to tell Sarah off? Again, you could read that as women are subservient and I need to go to the power of the house and say, get your affairs under control here. She's lying. Get her under control. Or you can read the scene. Who's being told off? Well, there's 50-50 here, right? Avram's being told off. Why is Avram being told off? Because he was told last week they were having a son. And Sarah's now shocked to hear it from angels. So maybe Avram is being told by God, you didn't want to share this news? You didn't want to tell her? She's been waiting all her life for a child. And now she's laughing. And she's trying to protect her. No, I didn't laugh. Don't worry. Maybe I knew. Don't. She says, yes, you did. Avram, you didn't tell her. And actually, she's being defended by God and Avram's being told off. And I thought that was a fascinating rereading of that. Either way, not particularly relevant to our moment. But, oh yes, it is relevant because that's when HaKadosh Baruch Hu twists the truth a little bit for the sake of peace. And this is the origin that actually lying for the sake of peace is legitimate in Jewish thought. So the brothers invent this, our father told us to tell you off. Yosef, on hearing the news that their father said this, breaks down in tears. Why does he break down in tears? He cries again. He cried when his father died. He cries again when the brothers tell him that Dad wanted you to forgive us. We're going to wrap up in one more minute. And he cries. Why is he crying?
They suspect him of not loving him.
So the Emek Dov and others say he knows that their dad didn't say this. He was with him day and night. And if he wanted them to forgive him, he had a pretty good relationship with Yaakov. Yaakov could have said, you should really forgive your brothers. So he knows that they suspect that he never truly forgives them. And that's his response. He says, look, I forgive you. I know what you did was with bad intentions, but look where we are now. Look how we ended up. We're on top of the world. I understand. Hatachat Elokim, Ani, am I in place of God? Actually, it's interesting. This has been read as redeeming the moment of the expulsion from paradise. Because what happened there was they ate from the tree of good and evil to become gods. And here Yosef says, Hatachat Elokim, Ani, am I in place of God? What you thought was bad ended up being good. Meaning human beings don't know what's good and what's bad in the world. Despite the fact that Adam and Eve ate from that tree and thought they were gods, we're not gods. And I forgive you because we're human. Now, there's a lot to read in to the second half of the Pasuk, but I guess that's a bit we'll put under pressure next year because I don't want to hold you and the time is late. But I will wish you all a wonderful Shabbos and remind you that next week I will be in London.
Oh,
So you're welcome to come with me. If you come, we'll do a share. Otherwise, I think at this time of day, I'll actually be heading to the airport now that I think about it, on the way back. So you can catch me in Heathrow. But I wish you all a wonderful Shabbos and a good week.